Daniel is only 12 chapters long. So Daniel's a small book, but it is incredibly important in our understanding, not just of the history of Israel, and not just our understanding of what God has planned. I think most people read Daniel in those two ways. They read it as a history, particularly a history of a man, Daniel, as if the book of Daniel is all about, you know, the things that Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego went through in the Babylonian captivity. And a lot of folks read the book of Daniel as all about end times, or maybe a combination of the two things. But it's all about, you know, what's going to come, these visions, these incredible visions of beasts and statues and stones and trees and all these things. And so they read it as a prophetic book, just telling us what's going to come. And both of those are accurate. And yet at the same time, I do not think either one, as a history or a prophecy, is the primary purpose of the book of Daniel. Rather, the book of Daniel is written and it shows us that God is Lord of history and of kingdoms. And that's what's going on. That's the overarching theme that runs through every part of Daniel, is the lordship of God over all the world. And so as we look at Daniel, I'm going to try to do this in 2 weeks, because it really, the book breaks down nicely into two parts. Chapters 1 through 6 are primarily focused on the history of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Chapters 7 through 12 are primarily focused on the visions of the end times. And I say primarily because there are some things in both sections that don't fit exactly into the way I described, but that's really is the big easy breakdown of it. So I'm going to focus this morning on the first 6 chapters. And as you've already shown in just reviewing what's going on in those chapters, we remember these stories. These are some classic Sunday school stories. They're images, very, very dramatic stories that leave these images in our mind of Daniel doing these incredible things. And so I'm not going to go through the stories much, except hopefully just enough to bring it to the point of each story. Chapter 1 introduces us to Daniel. So we have verse 1. In the 3rd year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God. And he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. So does anybody remember roughly when this happened? When Nebuchadnezzar first came against Jerusalem and first began to put it under his control? This is not the destruction of Jerusalem. This is when Nebuchadnezzar first comes towards Jerusalem. 606 to 608 BC is roughly when this was. We speak about the captivity of Israel in multiple waves, and this is the first captivity. Daniel is taken captive with a host of the best of Judah and Jerusalem. And so verse 3, then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans. And so this tells us something about Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego right off the bat. There's a good possibility that they are nobility, but that they definitely would have been very attractive, intelligent young men. They were the cream of the crop in Judah and Jerusalem. They had a very obvious capability to learn, to serve, to do what would be required of them in Babylon. These men are trophies of war. And so they are set aside. In verse 5, it says, the king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of the time, they might serve before the king. Now from among those of the sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. To them the chief of the eunuchs gave names. He gave Daniel the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. So they bring them in, they begin this 3-year training process to teach them all the ways of Babylon. This also, I'm certain, is intended to have essentially some brainwashing effect, to make them Babylonian citizens and to begin to squash their Jewish heritage, to make them no longer the individuals of the conquered nation, but truly servants of Babylon. But verse 8, but Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore, he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. I won't read all the rest of this, but Daniel recognizes that what they're being fed is in some way unclean. Now, the Bible doesn't tell us why. There's a lot of guesses that have been made. The major guesses or speculations on this is that it would have been just unclean animals, that Nebuchadnezzar would have had a lot of pork on his table, for example. Or the other one is that it would have been food that had first been offered to idols and been used in idol worship, both of which were forbidden to the Jews. But whatever it was, whatever the exact reason, Daniel recognized that eating Nebuchadnezzar's food would make them ceremonially unclean. It would violate the law of Moses. And so he goes to the man in charge of them, this chief of the eunuchs, and asks to be released from the obligation of eating the really, really good stuff. And he says, give me vegetables and water. The chief of the eunuchs says, no, I'm responsible for you. And if you stand there, you know, in front of Nebuchadnezzar and you look like you've been subsisting on vegetables and water for the last 3 years, it's going to be my neck. And so what does Daniel do? How does he respond to that? Yeah, he said, put it to the test. Give us 10 days with the vegetables and water and see how we look. What happened at the end of the 10 days? They were much healthier than the others. And so they now, for the next 3 years, ate vegetables and drank water. Verse 17, it says, as for these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom. And Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. And so it's very obvious that God is blessing these men. Verse 18, now at the end of the days when the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. Then the king interviewed them, and among them all none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they served before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in his realm. Thus Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus. So you have these four men at the end of their 3 years of training have shown themselves to be men of such diligence as well as God-given ability that when Nebuchadnezzar begins to examine them, he finds that they are far wiser, far better advisors than any of his other advisors. And so he appoints them a position very close to him. And how long did Daniel stay in that position of a chief advisor to the king of Babylon? Till the first year of King Cyrus. Cyrus was king of Persia who conquered Babylon. So Daniel, for the rest of the Babylonian Empire, was one of the chief advisors to the king of Babylon, not just Nebuchadnezzar. And this was about 67 to 70 years from the time that Nebuchadnezzar first brought Daniel and the other captives out of Jerusalem to the time where Babylon is conquered by Persia. It's just a hair under 70 years. And so for nearly 70 years, Daniel serves as chief advisor, or a chief advisor. I should not say the only chief advisor, but as a chief advisor to the king of Babylon. So that's all really background. Chapter 2 is where we get into the real meat of what's going on in the book of Daniel. Chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. And he calls his advisors to him, says, I had this dream. This dream is troubling me. Tell me what the dream is and what the dream means. His advisors say, tell us the dream and we'll tell you what it means. And Nebuchadnezzar is a little bit smarter than earlier kings and Pharaoh, for example, in that he says, no, if I'm going to trust your explanation of the dream, if I know you're actually able to interpret dreams, you need to be able to tell me what the dream is. If you can't tell me what the dream is, I don't know that you can tell me what the dream means. And they say, well, nobody can tell you what the dream was. You tell us the dream, we'll tell you what it means. He says, absolutely not. Tell me the dream, then tell me what it means or I'm going to kill you all. And they said, this is unreasonable and impossible. And Nebuchadnezzar said, okay, fine. You're all going to die. And the executioners begin to go around and to kill off the wise men and the astrologers and magicians that were advising Nebuchadnezzar. As they got to Daniel, Daniel apparently at this point had not been part of all this conversation. And he said, why are you doing this? And he pled for some more time. He asked the chief executioner to go back to Nebuchadnezzar and say, give me some time and I will tell you the dream and its meaning. And so chapter 2, verse 24, it says, then Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me before the king, and I will tell the king the interpretation. So verse 27, Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, the secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king. But there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these. And then he tells him the dream. Daniel says, Nebuchadnezzar, you dreamed about this great image. The head of the image was gold. The shoulder and arms of the image were silver. The torso of the image was bronze. The legs of the image were iron. The feet were iron and clay. Then Daniel goes on and explains to Nebuchadnezzar that God is telling him the kingdoms of the world that are to come. So the golden head is the kingdom of Babylon, which is Nebuchadnezzar. The silver shoulders and arms is the kingdom that is to follow, which we know is the Medo-Persian Empire. The kingdom of bronze is a kingdom to come after the Medo-Persian Empire, which we know to be the Greek Empire. The kingdom of iron is the kingdom that's going to replace the Greek Empire, which we know to be the Roman Empire. And we know that it eventually fractures and splinters into pieces, which we know to be the feet of clay and iron. So Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar, here's what you dreamed. Here's the meaning of the dream. But the important thing, you skip down to verse 44. After the breakup of the Roman Empire, it says, in the days of these kings, the God of heaven, which Daniel has already decreed is the God who is able to reveal secrets, who is telling Nebuchadnezzar what is going to come, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. One other key aspect of this dream that Nebuchadnezzar has. Sometimes we talk about the dream and the image and we stop with the image. The key aspect of Nebuchadnezzar's dream is not only did he see this image, he sees a stone that grows out of the mountain. It's a stone that is not cut by the hand of men, but it springs out of the mountain and grows and it comes down and it topples and crushes the image. So that what he now says in verse 45, inasmuch as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, and the great God has made known to the king what will come to pass after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation is sure. And so what's later going to be revealed in Daniel is that this stone crushes the kingdoms of the world. That it is going to establish his kingdom on the ruins of all of the kingdoms of the world. But Nebuchadnezzar's response is vital in our understanding of Daniel. Because it says in verse 46, then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel, and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. Now, there's obviously a misunderstanding of Daniel. He's basically worshiping Daniel at this point. But that the king of the Babylonian Empire, Nebuchadnezzar, who is by all means the greatest kings of what's called the New Babylonian Empire, he was responsible for the famous Hanging Gardens of Babylon, an incredible empire that he established. This king, who is more powerful than anyone in the world, falls down before Daniel, falls on his face in front of Daniel, and commands his people to worship Daniel, to make an offering to Daniel. And then he says, and here's the key point, despite his confusion about Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar is really clear. He says, truly, in verse 47, truly your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret. So what we see in this vision and dream and the explanation of it, the end result is Nebuchadnezzar recognizes that the God of Daniel is the great God, the God of gods. Chapter 3 is the story of the fiery furnace. Again, very familiar story. Nebuchadnezzar now establishes and builds this massive idol, this great figure. And he commands everyone, all of his rulers, to come and bow down before that image. And he gives the instruction, when all the instruments play, everybody bow down before this image. And Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are present there. So what did they do when the music started playing? They did not bow at all. And so Nebuchadnezzar brings them to himself. And he's fond of these guys. Remember, there is a definite fondness there that we saw in chapter 1 that I think we can rightly say continues to this point. And so he gives them another chance. And so you read down in the end of verse 15, he asks a question. Nebuchadnezzar asks a question of them, who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Well, he's about to find out. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If that is the case, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. This enrages Nebuchadnezzar, because it's just outright defiance. He orders them to stoke the furnace and to throw the men in immediately. It's so hot that when they open the doors of this furnace to drop the men in, the blast of heat kills their guards. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego fall into the furnace, and the only thing that is harmed are the ropes that are binding them. The ropes are burned off, and they're in the middle of this nice, toasty, warm furnace, wandering around, unhurt. There was not even a smell of the fire on them. Completely untouched by it. Verse 24, Nebuchadnezzar was astonished. He rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire? They answered and said to the king, true, O king. And so that's a pretty incredible event when you've got to say, wait, how many people did we put in this furnace? It was three, right? I said, yeah, it was definitely three. Yeah, at least we only counted three. He said, look, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire. And they are not hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. He sees the glory of this fourth one and recognizes that this is the deity. I do not think this is a confession of faith in Christ, or that he's recognizing even that there's only one God and that that is the second person of the Trinity. I think this is just more of a general statement of this one is clearly divine. He might be one of thousands of gods, but this is a God. And we go now to verse 28. Nebuchadnezzar spoke after Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had been pulled out of the fire. He spoke saying, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him. And they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree. Listen to this. I make a decree that any people nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made an ash heap, because there is no other God who can deliver like this. So chapter 2 ends with Nebuchadnezzar saying, your God is the God of gods. Chapter 3 ends with Nebuchadnezzar making a decree that if you say anything bad about the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, he's going to destroy you and your house. Then you get to chapter 4. And I will say, by the time we hit chapter 4, Nebuchadnezzar shows himself maybe to be a little bit slow on the uptake on some of this stuff. Because chapter 4, he has a dream. But he starts off, verse 1, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. So chapter 4 is a record of Nebuchadnezzar's own words, his own decree, if you will, his own testimony sent out to the Babylonian Empire. This is awesome. He says, I thought it good, verse 2, to declare the signs and wonders that the Most High God has worked for me. How great are his signs and how mighty his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. This is a rather astounding statement by the ruler of an empire to declare that there is a Most High God who rules over all the kingdoms forever. But that's what Nebuchadnezzar does. He tells of a dream he had, which he dreams of a large tree that is cut down and the stump is left there in the field for a period of time. Daniel explains the dream and says, this is what God is going to do. God is going to cut you down. You're going to be in the field for a period of time. You're going to be wandering witless. But then God is going to restore you to your power. And so Nebuchadnezzar later is walking through looking at all the great things he's done in Babylon, which is an incredible city. The archaeological recoveries from Babylon are astounding. Some of the most incredible things we have pulled out of that era of antiquity are just amazing in their beauty and their majesty. So Nebuchadnezzar is truly one of the mighty rulers of the world and of world history. And he's looking at all of these things and says, look what I've done. Look how great I am. And God strikes his senses from him so that he now spends, the Bible says, 7 seasons. There's question about how long exactly that is. I would lean more towards it was probably 7 months. But whatever, he spends 7 periods of time in the backyard, grazing, completely out of his head. And the Bible actually kind of makes a deal out of the fact that he's just out there grazing on the grass like an ox. And even his advisors bring out essentially a bale of hay for him to eat like he is cattle. And for 7 months, he is there completely out of his mind. And at the end of the time, verse 34, at the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven and my understanding returned to me. I would tend to say, after 7 months, Nebuchadnezzar repents. God restores his understanding, and Nebuchadnezzar blessed the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion. His kingdom is from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to his will in the army of heaven. And among the inhabitants of the earth, none can restrain his hand or say to him, what have you done? At the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my honor and splendor returned to me. My counselors and nobles resorted to me. I was restored to my kingdom. An excellent majesty was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all of whose works are truth and his ways justice, and those who walk in pride he is able to put down. It's an incredible testimony from the King of Kings on the earth, testifying of the magnificence of God, proclaiming throughout the land that the God of Daniel and the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego is the God of gods who rules kings and kingdoms. Now, lest we think this is just one religious fanatic of a king, we have chapters 5 and 6. Chapter 5 is Nebuchadnezzar's son, Belshazzar. He throws this great feast, this massive party. And in his drunkenness, they bring in the vessels from the temple in Jerusalem, the cups, the bowls, and all of these things. And they drink from the vessels dedicated to God. They drink from those vessels toasts in honor of their gods. He calls them the gods of wood and stone. And while they're in the middle of this drunken feast, they see something. What do they see? They see very literally the handwriting on the wall. This is where that phrase comes from. They see this hand begin to write on the wall. And it writes, "Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin." And what? Belshazzar has no idea. He calls his advisors in. They have no clue what's going on. Belshazzar's queen comes to him and says, "I remember a guy who was one of your father's chief advisors. And he worshipped a god who revealed dreams. It was that same god that put your dad in the backyard for that time. You remember this, Belshazzar? Call this guy. Call Daniel. He'll tell you what it means." And so Belshazzar calls Daniel and says, "If you'll tell me what it means, I will give you a beautiful robe, jewelry. I will make you the third most powerful man in the kingdom." By this point in time, Daniel is in his 70s or 80s. And he wants nothing to do with Belshazzar. He flat out tells him, "Keep your gifts. I don't want them." But here's the meaning. "Many, many" just means counted. "Tekel" means weighed. "Upharsin" means divided. So what they read was counted, counted, weighed, divided. And Daniel says, God is telling you that he has counted you. He has weighed your reign and your kingdom, and it is going to be taken from you. It's going to be divided away from you. Tonight, you will lose your kingdom. And that's exactly, exactly what happened. But verse 23, before Daniel explains what's going to happen, he says, "You have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. They have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your lords, your wives, and your concubines have drunk wine from them. You have praised the gods of silver and gold, bronze and iron, wood and stone, which do not see or hear or know. And the God who holds your breath in his hands and owns all your ways, you have not glorified." So Daniel chides Belshazzar for refusing to glorify God and to show that this God is truly the one who holds Belshazzar's breath, life, kingdom, and everything else in his hand. His kingdom is going to be taken away from him. So in verse 30, "That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old." So now we have actually the second kingdom of that image that Nebuchadnezzar saw, the Medo-Persian Empire. Very quickly, chapter 6 is the story of Daniel in the lion's den. Daniel was a chief trusted advisor of Darius. Daniel's fellow wise men were very jealous, so they plotted against him. They had Darius issue a decree that for 30 days no one could pray to anybody but the king of Babylon, knowing that Daniel's habit was to pray 3 times a day to the God of heaven. And so they make this decree, and what Daniel's response to it was to go to his room and pray like he'd always done. He opened his windows, he basically opened the shutters that covered the windows and faced east towards Jerusalem, and he prayed. And so they brought Daniel before Darius, told him what had happened. Darius tries to get out of it. Daniel is a favorite with Darius. And he recognizes that he has basically been duped by the jealousy of his advisors, and now one of his most trusted advisors is going to be put to death. And because of the law of the Medes and Persians, it could not be changed. That was kind of the law over all laws. Once you set a law, you created a law that could not be repealed. And so Darius has no choice but to throw Daniel into the lion's den. He spends a miserable night, sleepless night. Verse 20, he goes to the lion's den the next morning, and he called out with a lamenting voice, it says. Then the king spoke, saying to Daniel, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, deliver you from the lions?" Then Daniel said to the king, "O king, live forever. It's not exactly the response Darius or anybody else was expecting. Darius is groggy and sleepy, and Daniel sounds rather perky to me, at least as perky as you can be at 80 years old after spending a night in the lion's den. Even without the lions trying to kill you, it's probably not a comfortable place to sleep. The end result is those advisors who had led the campaign against Daniel, they and their entire household feed the lions, quite literally. Verse 25, then King Darius wrote to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. For he is the living God and steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall endure to the end. He delivers and rescues, and he works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. What we see, particularly Nebuchadnezzar and Darius, are men who proclaim to the world, all the world under their power, that at that time was really the center of the world. They proclaimed to all the world under their power that the God of the Jews is the God of heaven. It is striking that these two pagan kings are more evangelistic than most of the kings of Judah in all of the several hundred years of their history as the people of God. These men now declare very powerfully that God reigns and he reigns forever. It's very explicit. That's why I said the theme of a Daniel is that God is the God of history. He is a God who rules kings and kingdoms. And this is plain. Daniel 7 through 12, we're going to see how it plays out in the future. We're going to see what the God who is God of history is doing with history. So that Daniel is a remarkable book, not just because of the stories of courage and tenacity and faithfulness of the men like Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, but because and especially they show us God. They show us God as revealed by the mouth of understanding pagans. And we ought to listen. It should absolutely shape our understanding of world events today. So that as we view politics, we are now in the midst of another miserable election year with all this stupidity that goes along with it. And in the midst of that is a host of fear-mongering. No matter what side of the political aisle you're on, everybody is screaming, he's going to destroy America and they're going to destroy the world. If we go to this, he is the living God and steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed. Our God has a kingdom which is completely unmoved by whatever happens in the nations and kingdoms of this earth. So that I can look at all of this stuff going on in politics and I might be annoyed and I might even be righteously angry. But the thing I should not be is fearful, because I know the God who reigns. I know the Lord who is Lord of lords. And I know what he is doing. He told me. He's told us in his word. And we can look confidently even at what may seem to be catastrophe. Even if it ends up being a national catastrophe. I'm not saying that America is going to work out great and everything's going to be wonderful. I'm saying that even if, as we learned in Habakkuk last fall, even if the kingdom crumbles, God is still faithful, good, and sufficient. And his kingdom, which is our kingdom, reigns forever. So that we can stand in the midst of a crumbling kingdom or a toppled kingdom as Daniel did, and we can boldly serve God, because God's kingdom doesn't crumble, waver, and will certainly never topple.